stories we like to tell is like when getting up early in the morning with our dad, we used to go out and meet up with our uncles and work in the fields.
He was always into the winemaking side, but just did homemade stuff. But everyone loved it.
As members of the family, presenting the wines ourselves, it's very important for us. And I think it's important for people as well to put a face on the wine.
I was born and raised here. I love the family history. I love the seasons. So somewhere deep down, I knew I was coming back.
It evolved. It started with wanting to grow grapes.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 375. This week we feature Eric Cotton of Silvercrest Cellars in Madison, Ohio. cases seems like a fair amount of wine, but that's a typical number for a small winery to produce. Silvercrest Cellars in Madison, Ohio falls into that category. Eric Cotton is one of the three owners growing grapes mostly from the Grand River AVA in Northeast Ohio. The state of Ohio has a long history of wine grape growing, as well as producing many tasty wines. But take a listen, and Eric will tell you more. You can also hear Eric on our Vino Lingo segment of the podcast, defining the wine term, no terms. We're back in Ohio, my home state, and I'm here with Eric Cotton, and Eric is one of the owners of Silvercrest Cellars here in, are we in Madison?
We are in Madison.
We are in Madison. Oh, okay. Well, Madison, Ohio. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Thanks for taking the time on a Sunday morning, a snowy, leftover snowy Sunday morning.
No problem. It's a good time of year for hobbies. We start work outside very soon in another couple of weeks, so it's a kind of a nice relaxing time of year. I mean, now if you have hobbies, which you don't have time for, okay. Now is a good time for that because it gets busy real fast.
Yeah, I bet it does.
Here soon. So,
well, let's talk about the winery. It's very specific. We'll come back to you in a couple of minutes, but you're relatively new to the area, in terms of the winery, about a year and a half.
Year and
is
a half.
Right?
Yep.
And how did the winery come about?
So I was working at Bailey Controls in Wickliffe, and ever since I was in college, I thought, you know, someday I'd like to, you know, quit my job and grow grapes, make wine. I grew up on a farm. We had a farm when I was little, and so I knew what farm work was about. It wasn't a surprise to me, so it is to some. And I thought, you know, I enjoyed that lifestyle. I thought it'd be nice to, you know, get back to it. I never thought I'd be out here more than a couple years after I got out of college, but they kept paying me, and I thought, well, I can drive to the Cleveland airport just as easily as I can drive to the Atlanta airport or the Phoenix airport, so why not? And then I discovered that there was this nice, warm, strangely warm wine region out here east of Cleveland, and I thought, hey, I could start this while I'm still working. And so I bought some land out here 16 years ago, and, you know, started preparing it to plant grapes and started working in other vineyards. And I bumped into these other two guys who were also grape growers. And we said, hey, you know, instead of selling our grapes to everyone, let's go ahead and add value to our agricultural product. And we started this winery.
Interesting. Who are your partners then?
John Bohink and Pat Linehan.
Now, again, a year and a half, what was the planning process?
Oh, well, so while I was developing my vineyard, actually my brother bought some land just south of me, and we started planting grapes there, you know, while all this is going on, while our plans were developing. And it's another reason why I kind of stopped making plans, because all my plans were stupid and small. The original plan was I was going to, you know, put some grapes in my front yard and sell wine off the front porch, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
But then you keep, you know, you see more opportunity, and now it's wildly out of control, clearly. And while we were thinking, hey, we need a place to, you know, put our winery. We couldn't put it on my place; it was too small for grapes and a winery.
Yeah.
And this property became available. So this property was originally owned by Gerald Smith, and Gerald Smith had a vineyard up here, and right where in front of the winery,
sure,
where it is now. Yeah. And he passed away in 2006, and in 2012, you know, we bought this part from his daughter and son-in-law, who still live in the house down at the corner. And we rehabilitated the vineyard and, you know, built the winery here. We dug the hole in 2016. Then we poured an insane amount of concrete in 2017 and got our licenses and opened up in 18.
Well, now, this being Ohio, obviously different than places like Napa, Sonoma, there's still a lot of regulation, but it's not quite the same thing where you take 7-8 years to be able to do something.
Oh, yeah. So I'm active in Farm Bureau. I was the county president for 7 years. Uh-huh. I'm still on the board. And so as county president, we got to go to Washington, D.C. once a year. And one year we were staying in the hotel the same time as the California Farm Bureau was there. And there was some great people there. And we were talking and they were asking me questions like, so how many licenses do you need to start a winery in Ohio? I'm like, I don't know. Two? I mean, if you don't, minimum, I mean, there might be a couple others if you need to add a septic system or something, but you know, if you have a sewer and two, maybe. And they're like, two? It's like, we need 16 licenses. And it costs like $500,000 before you turn over a tablespoon full of dirt out there. And it's like, nope, that's not the way it is in Ohio. So it's kind of ironic that, you know, Ohio is kind of the Wild West now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of weird. But it's come a long way. I mean, there are lots of wineries and more opening, it seems, out here.
Yeah.
And it's done very well. So how many acres do you have here and how many acres are you farming?
So right here we have a little less than an acre. And between the three of us, about 20 acres, but everything's local. I mean, it's like my place, which is a mile south of here, my brothers, the neighbors, two neighbors down there. Mm-hmm. We have another neighbor up here whose vineyard we're taking care of, John's place, which, his family's farm is 3 miles north of here. And that's really the furthest away. So it's all local.
And is it all regarded Grand River Valley?
So everything except for John's place, mm-hmm. because the Grand River Valley is 2 miles either side of the river. John's is, you know, just a little too far outside the line, so we can't call it Grand River Valley up there.
So is that, then do you use it as blending, or is it just something?
Oh, that's so John's family's farm. It was planted in the 30s by his grandparents, and it's, you know, mostly Concord, Niagara, Catawba, and there's some hybrids. There's a section that they plant some hybrids in. We know one of them's Agawam, and the others, we don't know what they are. They planted some something. They're big and they're juicy, and they all go into a blend that we make called Rosie's Harvest. Rosie is John's mother's name, and it's her vineyard, so
nice.
She gets her name on the label.
Where we sit, are we just above the river?
Yes. So if you look at the label, there on the top of the label, there's a cliff. It shows a cliff in the river. That's right down there. Don't fall off.
No, I wouldn't do that.
But it's right there. So that's from a photo I took, you know, right down here looking north.
It's an interesting thing about Ohio most people don't realize is, especially when you get to the eastern and certainly southern part of the state, it's a very hilly state. Yeah. The western part, of course, is quite flat, quite different.
Yeah, and so we have, and it affects the wine also. So we have two different Cabernet Sauvignons. One of them is from my place, like a mile south here, and one of them's right here in front of the winery. And where the river is where the glacier stopped. So that last advance of the glacier, it stopped. And it, so south of the river, there's very little soil. There's a lot of rocks, so a lot of silt and siltstone and all sorts of other things. And on this side of the river, it's clay, and it's pretty deep clay. So we have these two different cab sauvs. We plant them, we pick them at the same time. They're made side by side, same yeast, you know, same temperature, same hillbillies in the basement fretting over them, right? but they taste a little different, look a little different. You know, one has a little more color, one has a little more tannins, but it's different every year. I think it's going to swap back the next year. We're in the 17s now, the 18s. I think the one in the front yard here is going to be a little darker, and then my place might be a little lighter. And we don't know why, except that it's just the soil's different, and I think they retain moisture differently.
Yeah.
So, you know, however that works out through the growing season is how the grapes develop.
And where we're at, we are kind of on a bit of a starting slope before the valley, am I right?
It's right here, it's very variable. I mean, you can see how variable it is. And like even the soil here, there's two different kinds of clay. There's a line that runs diagonally through the vineyard where we have one type of clay.
Really?
Yeah. And it's an effect of the glaciers. The glaciers, you know, they it's highly variable. So you can have 2-3 different soil types in a very small spot.
So what made you decide to become a winemaker? Because you're an engineer by trade.
Yes.
And obviously a successful one, and that's a great business to be in because you can do well. But going into the wine business is a bit of a different challenge financially.
It is. Now, ever since I was in college, I thought I would, for some reason, I just was attracted to wine, as many college students might be. But I'm a chemical engineer, and alcohol is why we have chemical engineers, as it turns out. So the first chemical engineering school was Edinburgh University, and they were making whiskey, and they're like, hey, this is good. We need to make a lot of this. How do we do that? And so they took mechanical engineers and said, okay, mechanical engineers, you're going to focus on, you know, tanks and pumps and pressure and distillation and all these other things. And that's where chemical engineering came from. And so I think I'm just going back to my roots, you know.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense. And it's not unusual to meet people from the medical industry or engineering because there's that scientific thing going on.
It's even more specific to that. So out of college, in college, I took a lot of process control classes and I got a job doing process control. And it turns out process control engineers go into winemaking.
Really?
So it's very odd.
Yeah.
So like Arnie Ester, he was a process control engineer at TRW. Art Petrick down the street, St. Joseph.
I know him.
Jim Ubelt also. And every year at this wine conference in Columbus, which we're going to next week, you know, you get some new people show up and you'll start talking to them. And it's like, okay, so, you know, what do you do? It's like, oh, I work for Siemens. Like, oh, really? Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, you're with your people, you're fine. Yeah. And it's just a strange thing. It's not uncommon.
No, definitely not. So when you guys opened up here in this area, again, Madison, Geneva, Harpersfield, there's a lot of great wineries here. And in fact, there's a relatively new one here to this neighborhood just up the hill from you. What kind of reaction did you get being a new winery to an area that's been making wine for quite some time?
So everybody, it's a very small community and everybody really, you know, helps each other out. Our neighbors, Laurentia, they were our first customer.
Really?
Yeah. So, on the day we opened, we put out the flag. You know, it was very low key because we never run a winery before. So we're just going to see what happens. Yeah. We're trying to learn fast. So we put out the flag and they were out working in the vineyard across the street. And they're like, they put out their flag. And so they all jumped in their truck and ran out here and walked in the door. It's like, you're open. I'm like, yes, we are. And they were our first customer. So they made me like print out the receipt and sign it. And
oh, cool.
Now they're great.
That's nice.
You get along swell with them. Yeah.
That's fabulous.
It is.
Well, I mean, you're farmers in the beginning.
Yes.
And that's what it's all about. So you do, farmers tend to help each other.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, all the other wineries, when they heard we were open, they were all out here, you know, the first weekend, you know, saying, oh, you got to do this. You got to do this. You know, and giving us a lot of good advice, which we heed.
Not a lot of businesses are that way, though.
There are not. No. Yeah, though, I agree.
It's nice. It's nice to be able to have that kind of, you know, here are some ways you can not make mistakes.
And, you know, the area is growing. We're getting a lot more traffic. Maybe a decade ago, people were worried that if there's too many wineries, you know, we'll be splitting up the market share. But that's not the way it's worked out. You know, like 30 years ago, you could go to both wineries in an hour, right? You know? Right. And so there was no reason to come out and stay or, you know, really spend a lot of time. But now, you know, you can't. So people are coming out for weekends. We have 2 new hotels up here on the corner. And in the summer, they're sold out. And
there's some B&Bs around here as well.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's...
it's becoming its own tourist mecca for wine. Well, it's a thing. You can, you know, spend a day going to a number of wineries here very easily. And what's really nice is they're all relatively close by.
Yes. It's all, I mean, the heart of the Grand Prairie Valley is only about 5 miles long.
Right.
Right. And there's about 30 some wineries in the area.
And a lot of people don't realize Ohio's winemaking or grape growing history goes way back.
Yeah.
On top of the fact, obviously, a lot of Concord grapes were grown here as well. So it's a daunting thing to think about opening a winery. As I said before, financially, it can be so stressful because you're dealing with Mother Nature. And Ohio, as we speak, I drive up here, there's snow on the ground. You said you're going to be dealing with the vines soon. I assume you're heading into pruning.
Yep, pruning fairly soon. Pruning. I start pruning like mad.
And very differently than California, it can be a little bit of a bear out there in terms of weather when you're pruning, right?
Yeah, it's cold. I know. I don't function. I've learned that, you know, 14 degrees, I can kind of function. 13, I stop.
Yeah.
So when it gets really cold or the wind's blowing, and it's like, you know, I just go a lot slower, and I'm thinking, you know, I could probably do this in half an hour in April. So why don't I just go ahead and pencil that in, you know, and just go back inside for the day.
But, just hibernate like everybody else does.
Yeah. But you got to start sometime or you'll never finish, right?
Well, that's a big job. Pruning is a heck of, that's probably.
It's the most technical part of it.
Yeah. You don't do it right. You got problems. Yeah,
you got a bad pruner. You can do a lot of damage.
So how many people do you have pruning when you're doing this?
Usually myself, Tim, you know, Pat and John help out where they can, but you know, John has his mother's own place to help with. And I'm pretty fast. So I'm the fastest pruner I know. So, you know, so it's almost to the point where if I get help, it sometimes slows me down.
Yeah. But, if you're showing somebody what to do.
Yeah. It's like, well, so we're going to do this and, you know, go about it really methodically and, you know, try and teach people and sometimes they don't come back. Right. So when you talk about how daunting it is, and it's farm work. And when I first came out here and I learned there was a grape grower out here who was looking for help. And I said, hey, I'll come help you. It's like, okay, sure. Because we do get people who want to help and they volunteer. And so, all right. So I went out and helped him. So, okay, we're starting at 10 a.m. It was in February. So we go out and we prune all day. He's looking at me like, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. You okay? Yeah, I'm fine. And then, you know, we wrapped up that day. And, you know, I call him up the next morning. I say, hey, what time are you starting? It's like, you're coming back? You know? I go, yeah.
That's funny.
You know? He's like, well, 10 a.m. So we showed up at 10 a.m. He says, you came back.
Wow.
I said, yeah. He says, nobody comes back. Usually they get one day and that's it. It's like, oh, man, this is horrible.
Well, anybody who's had experience in farm work in general knows this is, it's a very different planet.
Yeah. Yeah. And the farm I grew up on, we raised hogs mostly. And animal agriculture, it's a lot harder than grapes. At least, you know, grapes, you can take a day off. You know, with animals, you cannot take a day off ever, right? So, you know, in the wintertime, if I decide I don't want to work that day, well, guess what? I'm not working that day.
Yeah, that's a real luxury, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and the great thing about grapes is, you know, when it's 10 below, you don't have to get up and go out and chop a hole in the ice with an axe so your grapes can get a drink of water and you don't have to feed them every day, twice a day. You don't get phone calls from down the street saying, hey, your grapes busted out of your yard and are eating my flowers. Come over here and get them out of my yard.
That's the experience of a true farmer speaking
there. Yeah, so it's easy. Yeah, so this is not bad.
That's great. It's funny to think about that. So I'm curious now, again, just being Ohio, do you have any labor issues when it comes to harvest time? Are you able to get the people?
We're so far so good. There are some resources out there. There are different groups who are, you know, nonprofits who are looking to raise money for their nonprofits. So we can, you know, we can get them to come out. You know, if we can schedule a team to come out. And a lot of our stuff is are small lots, right? We do have a lot of very small blocks of different varieties, and we all keep them separate. And they all ripen at different times. So we might start in August, and we might finish in late October. Mm. And there's usually something every weekend. So we're able to kind of barely get it done, but you know, I'm keeping my eye on it.
Yeah.
You know,
are you doing any mechanical harvesting at all?
Not yet. No.
Do you think that's something down the road?
Yeah. Possibly? So the vineyards we put in, we put them in such that we could use a mechanical harvester someday. So we all use the rounded metal posts. So a harvester could come in, because, you know, the great thing about a harvester is, you know, if the grapes are ready or close or good, and it's Wednesday and there's a storm coming, you can go get them.
Yeah.
You know, nice. You can say, oh, today's the day. and you just go do it. Rather, it's like, well, I don't have a crew till Saturday. Well, you know, that's not great. Yeah, so that would be the, you know, one of the large main advantages to mechanical harvesting and less labor.
I think. Yeah. Interesting. Well, let's talk very specifically about the wines. We haven't gotten to that yet. Tell me exactly, why don't you just run through the list of the wines you're making?
Okay, so we do mostly vinifera. So because we're in this nice warm spot and we have some good warm sites, we can grow some red grapes that you can't necessarily ripen everywhere around here, but we have some nice warm spots. So we have Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Dornfelder. Dornfelder is it's a German red grape. Some is grown in the Finger Lakes. There's a little bit grown out here. They use it for blending mostly, but we have quite a bit of it, and it's turned out to be our most popular wine. It's a German red grape. It was bred in the 20s, and it was released in the 50s, and it produces a monstrous crop if you let it. It'll do 7 or 8 tons per acre, wow, which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's like Concord, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did in Germany, and it produced a kind of an average wine, and they used it for blending. And then in the 90s, they revised their German wine quality law, and they limited the production per acre. And so once they limited Dornfelder to a normal load, like 2.5 tons per acre, 3.5 tons per acre, it made a great wine. And so you didn't even really see Dornfelder by itself until about 2000 in Germany.
So what you're saying, there's a lot of fruit being dropped. Is that right?
Yeah, or you prune it to limit the crop. You don't leave so many buds. Sure. You drop crop early and try and bring it in that way. And it's the grandchild of Pinot Noir, so it's light in body. So it doesn't have the big tannins that you would see in, like, in a big cab, but it's very dark and very fruity and very spicy, like cinnamon, nutmeg, like baking spices. To me, it tastes like triple berry pie without the sugar. And it goes with a surprising number of foods. And it's kind of we call it the gateway wine, the red wine. It's the red wine for people to try who want to tiptoe. They've been through the sweet wines, now they're into the dry whites, and you want to tiptoe into the red wines. This is a good, gateway red wine.
Is it a drier though?
It's dry. We make it dry, and they do make it dry in Germany. There are some here that make it sweeter. But I don't think that's right. It's just not right.
So. Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, but it's so those are the reds, and we're going to do a Meritage with our Merlot here soon, and we have in whites we have Chardonnay, Riesling. We have a lot of different Riesling blocks around, and we make different Riesling styles. So we'll do a dry Riesling. We let it get riper, and the acid drops make a nice dry Riesling. We have sweeter Rieslings, and we have Gewürztraminer that we haven't bottled yet. We need to bottle that. And we do a Cab Franc Rosé that's very dry. It's bone dry. And the first one we did just as an experiment, and it sold out in 3 months. Oh, so I was like, hey, we got to make more of that. So we made more.
Yeah, people will turn against you if you don't keep making that stuff, right?
Yeah. So around here, I mean, traditionally you make a rosé, a Cab Franc Rosé, when you have a young block, and it's not going to be a big red wine. So you just pick it and make a rosé out of it. And then the next year you make regular Cab Franc. And that's what we did, except that it sold really well. So now we're doing it on purpose with grapes that could otherwise go to being a regular Cab Franc. But, that rosé is nice in the summertime. And we have Rosie's Harvest. And Rosie's Harvest is a blend of John's family's grapes. That's our sweeter blend that is, kind of traditional.
Yeah, sure.
But
training wheels.
Yeah. So, like 30 years ago, all the wines were similar to that out here. But, we're doing more vinifera. We're doing more, traditional international style wines. And I think there's a lot of people that haven't been out since they were in high school or college. Let's say college. Although the drinking age was lower back then.
It was. That's true. Yeah. We're so, both old enough to remember
to be
those
fair,
days.
Yeah. Yeah. People are starting to come back and say, hey, things have changed since we were out here.
So the one thing you haven't mentioned, which I'm a little curious about, and that is I didn't hear you say Pinot Noir.
Oh, we have Pinot Noir.
Okay. I think you mentioned it.
Did I did not mention it. Okay. So we have Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris also.
Okay, I would have been surprised because it's a wonderful area.
Yeah, and we have a little bit, not very much. We need to plant more, but you know, we have some land. We haven't planted anything new for a couple of years just because we were so busy getting the winery going.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But I'm kind of rested up now. I haven't ordered any vines, but we do have some more land that we can, you know, put into more grapes.
Boy, what a luxury to be able to have more land.
Yeah, it's. I think there's a lot of opportunity out here. There's a lot of land, good sites out here that could be converted into good grape land. And when I bought my property, I was looking at the topographical maps. I spent a lot of time. I mean, I'm a real nerd, right?
So, well, you're an engineer. Come on.
I know. So, and my old job was building chemical plants. So you do that right.
Yeah.
You know, there's no partial credit. A B plus is as good as an F when you're building your chemical plant. There's no mistake. So I was relentless with, you know, trying to get all the information, talking, you know, preparing, talking to everybody I could. And so when I bought this land, you know, I got it, I started clearing it. And then it was later that I found out that 100 years ago, it was called Vineyard Hill. I'm like, really? So, but Prohibition came, and for whatever reasons, you know, it was abandoned. And if you go deep into the woods, you can see where the old grape rows were.
Really?
And you can stumble over, you know, piles of wire and posts and things from way back. And so I think, you know, the old timers, they knew that was a good place for grapes, and it is. And I think there's more places, plenty of spots around here.
It's nice to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So Eric, when I came out here, you know, I'm from here originally, and just kind of drove up the road for a few minutes before I came down to the winery because I had a few extra minutes. And there were some what appeared to me to be abandoned vineyards, which is heartbreaking to see.
Yeah.
What, am I right about that?
Yeah. And it's a risky business. So there's probably three reasons I would say why they're, you know, you see these abandoned vineyards. One is there was a lot of Concord Niagara vineyards, and the price of Concord grapes hasn't gone up in 50 years, but the input costs certainly have. And so, you know, there are people who are struggling to keep those going, and, you know, they've done it their whole lives, but maybe their children or grandchildren don't want to work that hard for, you know, a tiny amount of money. Another reason is, well, they were good vineyards, and then we had the polar vortex of 14 and then 15, you know, 2 years in a row. Some people weren't able to bring their vineyard back from that, and haven't, you know, and once that happens, it's, you know, it's a 5-year proposition to rebuild your vineyard, and maybe it just wasn't, you know, they weren't up to that.
Sure.
And then there's another factor where vineyards are hard work. People sometimes get into them, you know, because they see the retirement commercials where you're sitting on the porch drinking wine, looking at your vineyard, thinking, look at me, I'm a grape farmer. And it's a lot of, you know, early mornings working till the sun goes down. It does happen from time to time. About 2 or 3 times a year, you do get to sit on your porch and drink wine and look at your vineyard. Yes. It's fun. I enjoy that, but there's a lot of work. And so I think people sometimes get into it not knowing how much work it is, and discover that you have to change your lifestyle to fit the vineyard and not the other way around. You're not going to put the vineyard on your schedule. So if you have a busy life, you're going to have to modify your lifestyle. And it is a change in lifestyle. And isn't, you know, if you're doing it for real, on a commercial level, then it's not a hobby anymore. It's going to take over it's your new lifestyle. So
that was a tremendous answer. Thank you. That was very, very good. I'm assuming you've been a wine drinker for the better part of your life. You mentioned college.
Yeah. I'm Episcopalian.
Oh, there you go.
So we start young.
Yeah, right. Did you take time to go to France or California or Oregon?
Yeah, so this is a good story. So when I was working as a chemical engineer, traveling everywhere, not the fun places. Oh. You know, it sounds glamorous to travel all over the world, but that's the ice sliding off the roof.
Oh, okay.
So it sounds glamorous, you know, traveling all over the world, but I didn't go to the fun places. Usually go to places that nobody wants to be and doing the things nobody wants to do. So that was my life for a while. And the company I was working for was a European company, and they gave us European style vacation. They changed their vacation policy to be really, really good. And then they started to go bankrupt. They were facing bankruptcy. And so it occurred to me, I need to use all this vacation right now. I mean, I need to put it in a pile and set it on fire. Okay, so I did that. So I took the summer of 2002 off, and I went to Germany. And the German Wine Institute had something they called the German Wine Academy. So I did that the summer of 2002, and then and also 2003, where I spent a really extended amount of time, where I went over there for a long time, came back for 10 days, paid bills, did some laundry, went back, came back in like September, October. And, you know, of course, you learn a lot. But I don't recommend that if you plan on keeping your job, because you don't come back from that. You don't spend 3 or 4 months eating the best food, drinking the best wine, go in the most fun places, come back, sit in a cube, and then have to do your TPS, you know, cover sheets. You don't come back from that. So I eventually did quit my job, because I was going to get fired if I stayed. Because you don't care anymore.
Yeah. But here you are.
Yeah.
You made a good decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for you. This has been great talking to you, but more importantly for our listeners who'd like to come visit, first of all, what is your website so they can learn a little bit more?
It's silvercrestwines.com. And we're on Instagram, Facebook. We're small. A lot of people involved in the winery still have their day jobs. I'm the only one that does this full time now. And we're only open Fridays and Saturdays right now. But in the summer, we just got our Sunday license here a couple months ago. So we'll be open on Sundays this summer. And we'll be adding more days as we can figure out a way to do that. But we pretty much sell everything we bottle right now. So
I didn't ask you, how many cases are you doing?
Cases. I see everybody uses different units, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. So
commercially, I hear more cases than anything.
Yeah,
else,
gallons. We're doing like about 4,000 or 5,000 gallons a year right now. So 2,000 cases, more or less.
Good size. Yeah. You know, working your way up there.
Yeah.
Eric, you came out here on a Sunday morning, which I really appreciate it. It's kind of cold, kind of snowy, but this has been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
My pleasure.
Learn more by visiting silvercrestsellers.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Copyright 2020.